Welcome to Headlines. This is Aryeh Leibowitz. I will be filling in for David this week as he takes a much-needed and, I believe, very well-deserved break from the show. We have a very interesting program this week. We'll be talking about what is known as Rabbi's Son Syndrome, which is the term that people use to refer to the tendency of children of Rabbanim to struggle with their father's public persona. Sometimes it makes the child uncomfortable that everybody knows who his father is, and he feels, whether accurately or not, that everybody's looking at him, sort of a fishbowl mentality, and analyzing his behavior. Sometimes he might feel that the expectations are greater of him than they are the rest of his community, or certainly the rest of his friends. He may also feel neglected because his father is acting as a father to the rest of the community, and sometimes at the expense of being a father to his children. On the flip side, when a child sees that his father is so relied upon by people and spends his life helping and comforting people, he may be inspired and want to become more like his father. And this is not obviously limited to the children of Rabbanim, but of really any public figure or anyone who's extremely busy. And we're going to talk to three very interesting and special guests, each coming from a different perspective on this issue. We will talk to Rav Shai Schechter, the son of the great Gaon and Rosh Yeshiva, Rosh Kollel and Yeshivas Rabbein Yitzchak Elchanan, Mori V'Rabbi, Rav Herschel Schechter, Shlita, but also a significant Talmud Chacham and Marbitz Torah in his own right. Rav Shai will describe what it feels like to grow up as the child of such a major Torah personality, someone who is constantly in the public eye, who had to take very public positions on things. We will also talk to the world-famous psychologist who is so heavily relied upon by every segment of the Orthodox community, Dr. David Pelkovitz. Dr. Pelkovitz will explain to us the psychological aspects and advise those of us in public jobs how to make sure we're giving our children the support that they need and make sure that they don't feel neglected. And finally, we'll talk to a great Chabad Talmud Chacham, Rav Baruch Oberlander, the Chabad Chief Rabbi of Hungary and editor of Or Yisrael Torah Journal. We'll ask him to address the issue of giving up a normal Orthodox community and upbringing of his children in order to spread Yiddishkeit and Chassidus, which is something that the Rebbe expected of all the Shluchim, and the Shluchim have done that. And we'll try to ask him both from a practical and a halachic perspective how to best balance a life's mission versus concern for one's own children. But before we get to our show, I want to mention a new sefer that our Achsanya Shel Torah, Rav David Lichtenstein, has just published after more than a decade of very hard work with an entire team of great Talmidei Chachamim. It is a two-volume sefer on Mishnah Berurah Chelek Gimel, on the Hilchos Shabbos section of Mishnah Berurah. It's called Mishnah Achrona, published by Oz Vahadar. The Sefer essentially gathers more than a century of halachic discussions ever since the completion of the Mishnah Berurah, and with incredible hekif and clarity, it discusses every possible issue on each sif katan of Mishnah Berurah. It also works very hard to show the seeming contradictions in the Mishnah Berurah. Sometimes you won't even realize that what the Mishnah Berurah is saying here seems to go against what the Mishnah Berurah says somewhere else. And it shows how the Gedolim have reconciled those contradictions. In the introduction, they write, Rav David writes, that they asked Rav Chaim Kanievsky if one can assume that contradictions in the Mishnah Berurah can be accounted for by simply saying that the Mishnah Berurah had, the Chavetz Chaim had a help writing the Mishnah Berurah. He didn't do it all by himself. His son wrote parts of it. His son-in-law wrote parts of it. So maybe that's why there are contradictions. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, absolutely not. That is not an acceptable way to be miyashev the stiras in the Mishnah Berurah, because the Chavetz Chaim certainly read all of it. He oversaw the project, and he certainly allowed everything to be printed. So there has to be a way to be miyashev when there are stiras, and the Sefer works hard on that as well. But primarily what it does is it really gathers over 100 years worth of halachic literature and comes up with every possible modern day issue that you could think of or that you couldn't think of, and discusses them with tremendous tremendous, tremendous Marumakomos. This Sefer is going to be an instant classic. In fact, Rav David told me that he published 12,000 copies of the Sefer, keeping 11,000 in Eretz Yisrael and shipping 1,000 to America. Well, all 11,000 have already sold out in Eretz Yisrael. I received my copy today and haven't been able to put it down. The availability in America is going to be on a first-come, first-served basis. I think the best way to describe the Sefer is that what the Masifta has done for Shas, the Mishnah Achrona does for Mishnah Brura. Really amazing work. Never could have been written by a single person, but somehow David found the time and energy to lead this team of writers and editors and Talmidei Chachamim and really create a phenomenal Sefer, an instant classic. Now for our riddles of the week. First, the Ran in Maseches Nedarim and Daf Zayin Amud Beis asks a kasha. The Gemara there proves that an ani is chashuv kameis, that a poor person is considered like he's dead, because the pasuk says in Shemos, ki meisu kol anashim mevakshim es nafshecha, and yet we know that Dasan and Aviram had not died. So the Gemara concludes, what does it mean that they were meisim if they hadn't died? It must be that they became poor, and that's why they were considered to be kameis. So the Ran over there asks the kasha. He says, a person who's poor is not the only one who's chashuv kameis. There's a whole list of people that are chashuv kameis, and included on the list of those who are chashuv kameis is mishein lo banim. Someone who doesn't have any children is also chashuv kameis. So how does the Gemara know that Dasan and Aviram were considered dead on account of their poverty and not on account of their childlessness? The question is that the pasuk says explicitly in Bamidbar. So that's the Ran's question. That's not our question. Our question is the pasuk says explicitly in Bamidbar, Perek Tzayin, Pasuk of Zayin, that v'dasan va'aviram yatsu nitzavim pesach aleihem v'nasheihem ubneihem v'tapam. The pasuk explicitly refers to the children of Dasan va'aviram. At the time that the pasuk says ki mesu kol nashim v'akshim es nafshecha, Dasan and Aviram's children were still alive. They had children. So how could the Ran ask that maybe the pasuk means that they didn't have children? That can't be what the pasuk means. We know that they had children. It's true that children ultimately died, but not at that point in the Chumash when Moshe Rabbeinu was told ki mesu kol nashim v'akshim. Then their children were still alive. A second riddle. The Gemara in Sanhedrin derives from the pasuk, "Unasati mimenu es trumas Hashem la Aaron haKohen," that you'll give truma to Aaron. That tchias ha-mesim is min haTorah. You see min haTorah that there's a concept of tchias ha-mesim, because Aaron never made it in Eretz Yisrael to receive truma. So if the pasuk is saying in the future you're going to give truma to Aaron, it must mean that there's going to be a time where Aaron's going to be in Eretz Yisrael receiving truma. Oh, you see, tchias ha-mesim. So the Aruch Liner in Nida Daf Samach Aleph and Beis asks in the name of the Sidrei Tara that the Gemara says in Nida, actually over there in that sugya, mitzvos betelos la'asadavo, that ultimately la'asadavo there aren't going to be mitzvos anymore. So if that's the case, even after tchias ha-mesim, there won't be any truma given to Aaron. So how can the meaning of this pasuk be understood as the truma that Aaron will get one day, if mitzvos betelos la'asadavo, then Aaron's not going to receive truma one day because we're not going to have a mitzvah to give truma to Aaron one day. So those are the two questions. And if, as always, you can call in or write in your answers. And Rav David in next week's program will announce the best answers, the winners of the riddle. Now for Dvar Torah on Parshas Korach. I'm recording this on Friday morning of Parshas Erev Shabbos Parshas Shelach. But it's figured it makes more sense, at least Parshas Shlach and Chutz La'aretz, makes more sense to say a Dvar Torah on Parshas Korach, because by the time anyone listens to this, we will at least be holding by Parshas Korach. The pasuk, in recounting the episode of Korach in Parshas Pinchas, you know, later in Chumash, we review what happened with Korach. The pasuk explicitly says that ubnei Korach lo mesu, the children of Korach didn't die. And the Ebenezer comments that this is very significant because the children of Dasan and Aviram, who helped out in this rebellion, they did die. And the reason for this, says the Ebenezer, is that Ra'as Dasan va'Aviram Kasha Mira'as Korach. The evil of Dasan va'Aviram was greater. What they did was worse than what Korach did. And that's why when we recount the story in Dvarim Perikid Aleph, the Pasuk says that the Onesh was Vasher Asa L'Dasan va'Aviram. Specifically, the Torah refers to what happened to Dasan va'Aviram, nothing about Korach. In fact, in Tehillim, when the Pasuk recounts all of the downfalls of the Jewish people in the Midbar, all of the things that we did wrong in the Midbar, and there were many, it says, Tiftach aretz vativla dasan vatchas al adas aviram vativareish ba'adasam lahavet v'ayit rishayim. Amazing that in recounting the entire story, David HaMelech doesn't think to mention Korach. Korach is what the whole thing was about. He doesn't mention Korach. Why are Dasan va'Aviram worse than Korach? And if they are worse, why does Korach normally get all the credit? Why is this called the rebellion of Korach if in fact Dasan va'Aviram were really worse than Korach? Another question, when Moshe first tries to deal with the rebellion, he calls for Dasan va'Aviram to meet with him. And amazingly, not to Korach, who is really his relative and presumably he could have reasoned with based on a previous relationship. What was his intention in reaching out specifically to Dasan va'Aviram? And a third question, Vayikach Korach is what they call a dangling modifier. It never tells us what Korach took. Rashi explains, of course, that the phrase means Lokach es atzmo l'tzad echad lios nechlak mitoche eda la'orer ala kuhuna. He took himself to one side to have a taina on the kuhuna. V'zeu shetirgim unklus v'ispalig nechlak mishare eda l'chachzik b'machlokas. He separated himself from the rest of the eda to strengthen the machlokas. He separated himself from the community because he wanted to create machlokas. Now that certainly justifies how Vayikach could make sense, but it still doesn't really explain, of all the words to choose, why choose the word Vayikach? Of all potential words to express the same exact sentiment, why would Vayikach be chosen? There are better words to describe how a person separates himself. Vayiparid would be separated, he separated. Why not say something like that? So I think there's the dual message of the machlokas between Korach and Moshe is really a message of proper Jewish leadership and of how to react when someone starts a machlokas and attacks you. First of all, Korach is described as a yikach because his entire purpose, his entire attitude is that of self-interest, of advancing his own agenda. It doesn't say Vayikhu, even though Korach had plenty of support. So it could have said that they separated themselves, because Korach wasn't interested in everybody else. He was only interested, his whole agenda was about Korach. And that's why Moshe's response is, Lo chamor echad mehem nasasi, I never took anything from anybody, no self-interest. You know, Harry Truman once said, you'd be amazed at how much you can accomplish when you don't care who gets the credit for it. And that's part of the idea behind going to Das Torah. People who go get Eitzah from great Talmidei Chacham and Gedolei Torah before they make life's decisions. What's the idea? Why are they going? Does the person know more about business than they do? Does the person know? They go to somebody who's just completely selfless, who doesn't think about what do I have to gain from this decision. And such a person is in a great position to advise. The great Talmud Chacham doesn't know more about business than you do, but if he is truly a great Talmud Chacham, if he is truly a Gadol Yisrael, he'll give an unbiased opinion without thinking about how he can benefit from your choices. And how many people do we really have in our lives that we can truly say that about, that are totally unbiased? And that's the first lesson of Jewish leadership. That, yeah, you're in a position sometimes where you're given a lot of attention, where there's a lot of focus on you, but it should never be about the leader. He should only be thinking about advancing the agenda of...
Really, this is a point about leadership as well, but really about all interpersonal interactions. When a person faces a rebellion or an attack, in the case of a normal person, the selfless person doesn't immediately become defensive and fight back. Rav Yisrael Salanter said, if you're right, make sure you remain right. A lot of times people start a machlokas, and when the machlokas starts, they're right. But by the time the machlokas is over, by the time they've escalated the machlokas, they've done so many underhanded things. We get into arguments sometimes with very good intentions, and even with the correct point of view. But as we become more enmeshed in our positions, we resort to tactics that are incorrect and unfair. We start to think that since we are right, we can speak Lashon Hara or stop being a mensch. But when we veer in that direction, we stop being right. Sometimes the best way to react is to retreat instead of to escalate. Moshe invites Dustin and Aviram for a conversation instead of firing back. He wants to talk with them. Let's talk it out. He invites them. It's only when that tactic failed that he had to engage in a more aggressive approach. You know, one time, one of my children got in trouble for something. He did something that he deserved it good. And the menahel of the yeshiva, Rabbi Tzvi Krigsman, is a master menahel. He's a master mechanich. Called the child in together with me for a meeting. And I was expecting, oh boy, he's going to give it to him over the head. He's going to... And when we had the meeting, father, son, and principal, to mark his re-entry into yeshiva, the menahel, the entire time, only showed love, support, encouragement. I'm so proud of you for accomplishing X and Y and Z. Up until this minor slip-up, you've been so wonderful. Because the menahel knew with his pikchus that the punishment was loud enough. Everything can be expressed at this point, benachas. Now the point is not to escalate the situation, but to de-escalate the situation. He got the message of what happened, and now he has to know that there's going to be an ongoing relationship, and it's going to be a positive one. When Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldwich, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Keren Biavna, asked the Lubavitcher Rebbe whether his son should stay learning in Panovich where he was learning, or to become a Rebbe at Keren Biavna, you know, start earning a parnasa, and obviously with his father being the Rosh Yeshiva, which I guess is apropos of today's show, with his father being a Rosh Yeshiva, he was going to be able to get him a job. The Rebbe could have said, you know, we're not going to get into it right now, but let's just say the Rebbe's relationship with Rav Shach was machlokas l'shem shemayim amongst Torah giants, but it wasn't smooth sailing. And the Rebbe could have said, stay away from those rotten panovichers, you know what they say about me, they bad mouth me. No, nothing. He said, the boy should stay in learning. He's happy, he's matzliach, let him learn. When somebody yells at you, you speak back calmly to them. You retreat a bit instead of escalating. That's such an important and powerful message. The opposite of de-escalating are the likes of Dasan and Aviram, who according to the Ibn Ezra were worse than Korach. Unlike every other character in the rebellion, Dasan and Aviram have no motivation or self-interest. They're only interested in machlokas, like flies who are drawn to tzoa, you know, they're drawn to garbage. They look for a good fight. It's bad enough that most people fight the fights that they're directly involved with, but Dasan and Aviram look to involve themselves in fights of other people. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu specifically summons Dasan and Aviram when trying to de-escalate. He's specifically targeting those who are most responsible for blowing the machlokas up to larger proportions. So machlokas, you know, it's an important part of our religion. We're people who engage in debate, healthy debate. We're imbued with a certain rizch d'oraisa. We have a passion, a fire, and without that, we wouldn't be us. We wouldn't be the Jewish people. You know, the Gemara talks in Kiddushin about an avu b'no, rabu talmido, that learn Torah together, that nothing ka'oid themselves. They become like enemies, but by the end, they become ohavim. So I think these two messages of making sure that we're not in it for ourselves, that it's l'shem shemayim, truly for a higher purpose, and that we can argue correctly without unnecessarily escalating things until they get out of control, and make sure we maintain a deep love for the other side. It's within our grasp. It's really what the point of this show really is. For those who've listened, when Rav David does the show, there are some heated debates. There are some significant arguments. But as long as both sides can respect each other, as long as both sides can express themselves with great passion, but it's not about me, it's not about my kavod, it's about finding the MS, it's about expressing a machlokas l'shem shemayim, and not trying to escalate things and making things personal. then the machlokas is a kiddushim shemayim. I don't do that so much when I host the show. I'm just more trying to get the opinions of people. But really, it's a very in a certain sense, it's a very, very healthy thing. It's the critical lesson that Moshe Rabbeinu taught us so many years ago, and Gedolei Yisrael continue to teach us in each and every door.
We're now joined by Rav Baruch Oberlander, who is an Av Beis Din of Budapest, Hungary, and a Chabad Shliach in Budapest, a very serious Talmud Chacham, and I just want to thank Rav Oberlander for taking from his time to talk with us. Welcome, Rabbi Oberlander.
Hi.
So I just want to ask a couple of questions, particularly, this whole show that we're doing is about the particular challenges that are faced by children and families of Rabbanim and of people that are public figures. And I thought that from a Chabad Shliach perspective, there are very, very different kinds of challenges. And maybe you'd be able to help us shed light on some of the halachic aspects of it. So first, let me maybe just to start with a discussion of the mitzvah of Kiruv in general, because if there's going to be some sacrifice, we have to understand what we're sacrificing for. So what exactly is the mitzvah of Kiruv? Is it an extension of Tochacha, of Kol Yisrael Arevim, Hashavas Aveda, like by saving a life, Avas Hashem, like the Rambam in the third mitzvah and Sefer Mitzvos, that when you love something, you want to share the love with others. What exactly is the Mechayev of Kiruv?
And it's a very good question, and I think we could talk a long time on the chiyuv of kiruv. But I think I should quote a tshuva of the Tzelem Rav in Shalish Tshuvas Migdalos Merkochim Yeridei Chov Zayin. He asks a question over there: if you should send a mashgiach to a farm to have Chalav Yisrael, So he writes over there. He says that no problem if he doesn't have minyan. Vim eifshur lele yispalel klal as poter legamra mitzvila ki oisig be mitzvah poter min a mitzvah ve'en lecha mitzvah gedoyle mizu melahatzil ish mi Yisrael machila streifes. So this is he was a serious rav. He says to be mezakeh one yid, a lot of yidden, Me'achila Sreifes, you potter mitfila. It's just, now, what is...
I would just, is it possible to argue that in a situation where a lot of people who are otherwise Shomer Torah mitzvos are not going to have kosher food, and if you don't hold the Ramesh's Heter of Chol of Yisrael, then certainly not having Chol of Yisrael is not having kosher food, is that maybe different than going out and finding people to be Makari, people who have not really crossed your path? Meaning, couldn't it be like that my chiyuv of kiruv is to deal with my coworkers, my neighbors? Meaning, do I have to go out of my way to find sick people so I could do bikur cholim? Do I have to go out of my way to find aveilim, to be menachem aveilim? Or when I know of someone who's sick, so I have a mitzvah of bikur cholim?
Okay, so the question, you could put the same question. If somebody asks me that he needs a chol of Yisrael, I'm going to go. Do I have to make sure that all the stores should have Chol of Yisrael if somebody comes in? But listen, this is just the point. This is the point. What is behind that is, first of all, behind that could be the mitzvah of Toichocha. For example, I'm going to quote, it's the Rambam, and the Shulchan Aruch Harav brings it to Simakuf Namvav. Haroyas chaveiro shechoto, o sheholach bederech loy toiva mitzvah olav lachziro ilamutav. So this is one point. Although it says over there that if it's because nechasorin emunosam beisur she'os koshem oit limchiz miyodam, then it's not a chiyuv. Interesting enough that the Rambam, when he talks about the tinek shenishba, uses the lashon ro'ui lahachziram b'tshuva. Ro'ui means it's a nice thing. He doesn't use the lashon chiyuv because could be taka. There's no, not the mitzvah of teichocha. But
it's also,
for example,
possible that you're not really in full control of it. So rahi lachzirim, because you have to do your best, but you don't know that you'll be able to be machzirim.
Yeah, but you can't. You don't use roi. You should do it. Roi lach zira. Ah, means okay. Could be. But the Chacham Sofer in Pituchei Choisim in beginning of Shalosh Yehudos in Yeridea says we see from the mitzvah of Teichocha, from the mitzvah lematem oisam es beneichem, that the Torah doesn't want a person to be busy himself. A person has to be a yid has to be busy teaching. Really, the mitzvah of lilmoid or lalamoid, it's very hard to say lalamoid should only be when a bocher a mitzuyan comes that you should teach him. But if somebody is not a mitzuyan, and he's far from a mitzuyan, you shouldn't teach him. It's very hard. For example, you could use another point over here also, which is dalocha in Hilchas Shabbos in Menshin Vav. That Misha Sholcholoi Sheitziu Bitoi, that if your daughter is taking away, somebody's daughter is taking away for Shmad, then you should be, the person should be Machal Shabbos, and even if it's a Malacha Gemura, means a Malacha Deoraisa, matter of fact, once I used this Halacha here, a person I had over here had a daughter for years, was in a certain cult, and once she called him up, that there was some misunderstanding, got into a fight. And she said she was somewhere in Europe. Says, I don't have a passport to come home. So I told the person, travel on Shabbos, get the passport there as soon as possible, because if she's going to go to the embassy and ask for a passport, things might change. He didn't travel, and she changed her mind. But if we're talking about a person has to. Has a chiyuv of lelamed, and to the point that Michal Shabbos for saving somebody from shmat, I guess this is a pretty strong chiyuv of teaching. Or Reb Shimon Shkop brings that a person has a chiyuv of giving meiser from his time for teaching, not only meiser from his money, but meiser from his time.
Rav Meiser writes this way in the Tshuva, that he gives meiser from his time. Yeah. Rav Shimon in the Hakdamah to Shari Yosher talks about how HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusts you with money, and you're supposed to do mitzvahs with it. But he also says, "Meister of your time." I didn't even know.
Yeah, this is the Meister of your time. If we're looking for other sources, for example, the Tanya Nigeres HaKodesh Tezayin writes, "Chayecho Koidmim is only when we're on the same level. He needs something, I need something, so chayecho koidmin. But if the other person, it's chayim v'lamavis, and for me it's just a step ahead, then he goes before.
Very good. So I just want to stop you there, because you said so many very important things. The idea that you have to keep on teaching, even if it's a person who's not the greatest Talmud, that anyone could be the Rebbe for the Tzaddikim, but everybody needs a Rebbe.
Rebbe Preda for 400 times.
Rebbe Preda, yeah, that's what it brought to mind, Rebbe Preda, exactly, teaching 400 times. But, you mentioned that the Chiyuv of Talmud Torah is the way the Rambam starts out Hilchos Talmud Torah is that he starts out with his pater, but even when he talks about the chiyuv to be to learn Torah, he first talks about the chiyuv to be melame Torah. Yeah, but primarily the way it appears in the Torah certainly is limatim es b'neichem, and that's really where I want to sort of like now move this conversation a little bit, because you very correctly and very passionately pointed out that a person has to give up a lot of himself in order to teach Torah to other Yidden, in order to be makariv them. How much does a person have to give up, or is he even allowed to give up from his children's chinuch in order to be in a position to be mashpia on other Jews?
There's no question that kiruv shouldn't be, what is it called, a valving door. That Makariv one, and from the other side we're losing another one. Meaning you're Makariv a kehila and you're losing your family, your kids. Surely that's not the point. Because for this, for surely you could say chayachu koidmim. But the question is, why do we think that by doing kiruv, I'm giving away from my own kids? I think it's the opposite. Kids that grow up in such an environment are always in the tenua of giving, of teaching, and they feel always that they have an obligation of trying. You know, I see my little son is trying to help somebody in shul, finding the right page, whatever. And sometimes other kids that don't grow up in such an environment don't feel this this achrayus for somebody else.
Yeah, I very much hear that. I was at a Chabad Kinnas Shluchim a couple of years ago, and the shaliach from one of the islands where there were terrible storms spoke, and he told a maisa, just an unbelievable maisa, about how there was no electricity on the island, and everything was a churban, everything was destroyed, the mikvah, everything was destroyed, and he had the opportunity to get off, and to get, you know, they were rescuing people, and his shaila was, should he go with the rest of his family to go off the island, or should he stay behind to help the people that were still there? And he said that his 5 or 6 year old son said, "Tati, if you go, who's going to take care of our yidden?" And it was just such a, like, you can't teach that to a child any other way than experiencing it, I would think.
Absolutely. There is a very interesting midrash in the end of Parshas Vayakel. The midrash says, it says, "Ra'ei kora Hashem b'shem b'tzalel ben Uri ben Chur." So the midrash says, why is Chur mentioned over here? So the midrash says, because he was moiser nefesh for Hashem, that's why Hashem makes sure whoever is moiser nefesh for him, that his chur is going to have very good kids. Interesting, I saw in the Sefer Beis Yaakov, he says that that's why we see all the big tzaddikim. It says, "Kmo shereinu beineinu mimoyri zal mivorka." The Vorka Rebbe, "Asher tomid mosar nafsha avur toivas b'nei Yisrael, neida bebiru shebneim ayoytzim em yudoichsim v'afarchim kemoshal." So meaning, by teaching by example, and by giving the kid the feeling of achrayus, the kid is gaining, no question.
Yeah, but you know, I would certainly agree that if, you know, that it seems obvious that if it were a shaila of losing your children, chas v'shalom, versus being makariv, that like you said, chayecha kodman. But I would imagine, and again, I'm not a Chabad shliach, I don't know, but I would imagine that very often there are more subtle types of compromises. Like, let me give lamashal. You invite people over to your house, so your house is sort of an open door kind of place. And there are women that come, and women don't always dress so tzniyistic. So your child is exposed to something like that, where otherwise he maybe wouldn't be exposed to it. Is he going to go off the derech because of it? Probably not. But, you know, but is it costing something? When, you know, and this is not just Chabad, there's any kiruv, that when you're involved with people who aren't living a religious lifestyle, there's just going to be a certain exposure that the children have that they otherwise wouldn't have. How does one balance, you know, the positives versus those kinds of more subtle exposures?
Kids are always exposed to a certain extent, even if they live in a closed ghetto, but they go to a doctor's office, they're exposed. If they go, you know, I don't think, especially if you try to teach the people that come to your house that they should dress. When they come to the Rav's house, they should dress. Again, the message is the other way around. I don't see... sometimes when it comes to Kiruv, people suddenly become more sensitive than by taking the kids to a trip to great adventures where they're exposed in the middle of the summer. And nobody has second thoughts about taking the kids to great adventures on Chol HaMoed or in summer camp. So
I wouldn't say nobody. There are people that do have that would refrain from such things. But yeah, in economy, your point is well taken. Yeah,
It could be some people, but you know, I don't see people. I'm not saying try to. I know not to try. People are able to not to expose the kids to a certain point. So, other way, when you hear the your father teaching tznius, your mother teaching tznius, then yotzo have seidoi bischoroi.
Yeah. Okay. Very often the Chabad house could be operating in a community that can't get a daily minyan, and sometimes they can't get a Shabbos minyan. I know you mentioned before that with Chol of Yisrael, let the Mashkiach, miss a minyan, let the Mashkiach miss davening because he's also the mitzvah. I think you said from the Tzelem Rav, because he's also the mitzvah. But can you make that sacrifice for your whole family, that they're going to lose Tchila B'Tzibur, they're going to lose the ability to daven with a minyan?
When we're talking about, let's say, 100 years ago, when every city and town had a rov, did they all have minyan? For example, the papa rov, the Vayaged Yaakov, his first rabbonus was in Likav. And I spoke with somebody, he told me in Likav, there was minyan only on Shabbos, because there weren't enough people, everybody was torud, and there was only minyan only on Shabbos. And I could tell you many more stories of big rabbonim that started their rabbonus in small towns where there was no minyan during the week. So there's the only way of building a minyan that you're there. I know many places where you go and there's no minyan, and 5 years from now, there's a nice minyan, and 20 years from now, there's two minyanim because whatever. And then you have from Eden, whatever. You have to start somewhere. And that's why all these Rabbanim, when you see the list that Milafonim, Avid, Bekila is 1, 2, 3, 4, you also always have to know that the first one or two were so small that a lot of times didn't have any minyan. And, this is talk about being Zaka Am Yisrael.
Now, from a Talmud Torah perspective, when you're moving to a place that doesn't have the kinds of yeshivas that normally you would send your children to, or that maybe you were even zocher to go to when you were a child, what does a parent do? Does he just have to make sure that he spends hours a day learning with his own kid, like the Torah says, like the Torah says a person's supposed to do? Or like how does one deal with that kind of issue? From Yeshua ben Gamla, it's always been taken care of by somebody else from the days of Yeshua ben Gamla, with a father supplementing. But how does that work?
This used to be probably the biggest problem that Chabad Rabbanim and Shluchim had to face when they went to different faraway places. The last few years, they developed what's called an online school, and my son was, I think, the first year of that online school. He's married already with a kid, so we're talking about 15 years ago at least. They started an online school with a malamed, and they learn chumash, gemara, and halacha. So it's from the mitzvah Talmud Torah side. The Baruch Hashem, the problem is solved. You could say that it's not so, it's not always so comfortable for the kids to have virtual friends and virtual malamed that talks to them, sees them. The whole idea is online school. You see the malamed sees you, and you see the other kids, and it's interactive. You ask questions, and they have tests, and by lunch they play and they fight, and they. In the beginning, the first year, my son was on. So he was on like in the afternoon hours. Why? Because they had to take, Siberia, Budapest, and Alaska should be together because it was the first year or the second year. So they tried, but now they have already, on regions. So you have Europe, Hebrew, and so it's now it's comfortable, normal hours, they daven together and they learn together, and Baruch Hashem.
Wow, and it's all in either English or Hebrew? That's how they work it out?
That's what I know. I didn't hear of Yiddish classes, but Hebrew or English they have.
You're saying or Hungarian or German or any other Chabad Shluchim?
No, so I'm talking Europe has mainly Hebrew. Europe has Hebrew. You know, my kids don't use it anymore because now we have a Baruch Hashem, a nice big school, and we learn over there in Gemara and everything, you know, in the Cheder. But in the beginning, we're talking about 15 years ago, we had already a school, but it wasn't up to that level yet. So we used it online school. But here, anybody in Russia or anybody in, you know, the end of Texas uses this online school. And it's a great program. Good Malamdim and a great program.
I guess socially it's not as the same, but educationally.
It's not the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. Socially, it's not the mitzvah.
And like you said, there's a trade-off. He may be losing out on having friends that live nearby, but he's learning valuable lessons about taking care of Klal Yisrael. But let me ask you just more general, not Chabad related, but we spoke to Rabbi Shai Schechter, who's the son of the Gaon of Herschel Schechter from Yeshiva University, and he spoke a little bit about what it was like growing up, seeing his father's name in the newspaper all the time and in the blogs, and you know, especially Rav Herschel Schechter is sort of in between different worlds, and so he's subject to criticism from the left and criticism from the right. And is it usher for a child to get involved in defending his father? Meaning, is that like what the Gemara says, not to get involved in your father's conversation? Is that a lack of mora'av? Or can a child say, you know what, I know that my father's a tzaddik and these people are misrepresenting him, and, you know, write a letter to the newspaper or to make a comment or something. Is that an isser? And then second, I guess, if it's not usser, is it at all valuable to do?
What we always see in the, you know, in the Ilam HaLocha, if we're talking about the Tur and the Rosh or other, you know, the children, the Einiklach, try to defend the parent, the father, the grandfather in the world of halacha, in the world of Torah. But to write letters, the newspaper, I practically don't feel it's useful. I practically don't feel that my kids should get involved in such things. You know, Anan Pala, the Imam Anan, should be busy, you know, spreading light and not fight with darkness. Meaning, to the point that I don't feel myself that I should get involved defending myself most of the time. Most of the time, you know, the record defends itself better than anything else.
I find that when you respond to things, sometimes it just elevates the whole, it just escalates the whole issue. You ignore things and they go away eventually, and MS will ultimately stand.
They say the worst thing you can do to a mistake is publish a correction.
Then everyone recognizes me. Yeah, I hear. That certainly makes
but
a lot of sense.
There's another very important thing that I just saw recently. It's brought down from the Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer that, you know, we always, you know, Hashem said, you know, that Avraham Avinu did so much for me, Eschar Chahar B'Moed, because you spread my name. The Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer says that Chazru Kulam Lesuran, that Avraham Avinu worked very hard, Avraham Megayer Anoshim, Sura Megayer Anoshim, but they didn't stay. And still, Avraham Avinu gets all the schar because he worked so hard, so hard for the Eibishter. I heard in the name of the Griz that he says, but at least, you know, there was a story, you know, somebody was teaching and the kids afterwards went away. He says, while you were teaching, they said Shema. So, you know, that's full of the revach. So meaning,
yeah,
we have to do kiruv.
That's what you have. Eben Ezra, I think, points out that Kalev, you know, is a hero of the story of the Meraglim, but Kalev and Yeshua both, but Kalev, with all of his big speech, he ultimately failed. I mean, they didn't listen to him, but I think they point out that, yeah, he ultimately failed. But in that moment, they paused. In that moment, they stopped complaining. So that moment is a win also, even if it wasn't long-lasting.
Yeah, so, you know, so Avraham Avinu himself was busy doing Kiruv, but he didn't have too much success, but he did it. So our job is to do, and Abish's help, we should have success.
More to the directly to the to, I guess the topic of this this show on the Avraham Avinu issue. Yeah, the Rambam says in Megari tens of thousands of people, and like Pirkei Avot says, they were all gone. But the one that wasn't gone was Ki B'Yitzchak Yikarei L'Chazera. That ultimately he had to make sure. The most important was that he was mechanich his own child properly. So I guess that's just an important hashkafa that a person should always have, to make sure that you know, the Ribbono Shel Olam gave you the ability to be mashpia on a lot of people, but one person for sure, or one set of people for sure, that the Ribbono Shel Olam expects us to be mashpia on is our own children, because he gave us the responsibility of them. So you know, that's, I guess, more along the lines of where we're trying to go with this show, that we have to make sure that our children are taken care of.
No question. There's also another point that I was thinking. When, you know, we're talking about 100 and 150 years ago, when, you know, they had the Achnosis Archim in the city, and all these Archa Parche were invited to the house, and it was the big Mila of Achnosis Archim. These Archa Parche, there's only once in a while that you found the Shagas Arya between the Archa Parche. Usually, yeah. These Archa Parche were very prost people, and they also brought into the house sometimes, you know, nivul peh and, you know, different hanhaga that wasn't the best. But, you know, we're talking about Achnosis Archim, these were the people that, you know, the Archa Parcha are very, very simple people. And this is Achnosis Archim.
Yeah. I was friends with a Yid who passed away already, or Shlomo Tversky, in Lawrence. And he told me that his father was a Hasidic Rebbe, Kamuvan, his name was Tversky. He said his father was a Hasidic Rebbe. And he said one time at his Simchas Beis HaShoeva, he had a tish in his sukkah, there was one fellow that came that was mamish, so inappropriate. He was inappropriately dressed. He was talking inappropriately. He smelled. He was and the Rebbe sat him right next to him the whole time. And someone said to the Rebbe afterwards, "How could you put such a person next to you? Why did you, you know, let him sit in the back?" And he said, "Because I'm going to go to the Olam HaEmes L'Achrameyav Asrim, and I'm going to ask for a seat next to Moshe and Aaron, next to David and Shlomo, next to Abaye and Rava, and they're going to tell me we don't belong here, and I'm going to say, when I was down there, anyone could sit next to me. So my schar should be that I should be able, even though my neshama smells a little bit, it should be able to sit next to next to the Gedolei Olam."
So this is Kirov. This is Kirov, especially that a lot of these people are later on not going to smell anymore.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Rabbi Oberlander, I appreciate so much you took your time on an Erev Shabbos especially. I so thoroughly enjoyed hearing your perspective, and you seem to be so malev v'gadosh with Torah. Thank you very, very much for joining us today, and have a wonderful
pleasure.
Shabbos.
Pleasure. Should help. We should be able to do a lot of little noid, and a lot of little amid.
Amen, amen. We welcome to the program now Rabbi Shai Schechter. Now, Rabbi Shai Schechter is the Rosh Beis Medrash of the Young Israel of Woodmere and is a very prominent Marbitz Torah, someone who speaks all over the place and speaks to all different kinds of Jews who appreciate his derech in Limud HaTorah and in Harbatas HaTorah. And we're specifically interviewing Rabbi Schechter today for this program because Rabbi Schechter is also the son of Hagon HaRav Herschel Schechter Shlita. And I thought he would provide an interesting perspective on what it's like to grow up as the child of a public figure, and particularly of a Gadol B'Yisrael. And in a certain sense, this discussion is going to be about what it's like to grow up in the limelight in general, but Rabbi Schechter's experience is very unique, because his father's not just a rabbi, he's a Torah giant. He's been a Rosh Yeshiva for over 50 years. But I think, Rabbi Schechter, first of all, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for agreeing to speak with me today.
But thank you.
I think a pleasure. When you would learn with him as a child, would it just seem different? I mean, I can't imagine having a chavrusa with Rav Schechter as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 7-year-old. How did that go?
So I assume we're allowed to be very honest on the show. I assume that's what you're looking for.
For sure.
as a child, it's actually extremely challenging to learn with someone like Rav Schechter. My father, you know, used to sit and learn with us, and we as children were not really understanding why he was light years ahead of us and why every single question we had he knew the answer to right away, and why it is that my father has no problem sitting for hours on end and learning, and, you know, there's nothing that bothered him about the fact that we missed a lunchtime or a dinner time. I remember after I got married, and a little bit before, I had a great schus to learn the Chavrusa with my father for 9 years in yeshiva. And we used to learn every day second Seder, and a few days a week we would learn night Seder as well. And there were a number of times, I speak to my wife about it all the time, how we were just newlyweds, and Seder officially ended at 6:30. And my father, if he didn't have a shir that night, he just carried on because we were in the middle of a sugya. And it was 7 o'clock and 7:30 and 8 o'clock and 8:30 and 9 o'clock, and he literally had not looked up from his Gemara. He's a tremendous masmid. And my wife was waiting outside. At the time, my cell phone was always off when I learned with my father because he's so focused. And if you lose focus while learning with him, even for a short period of time, you know, you really get lost. So my phone was always off, and I, you know, it could be 2-3 hours that we would go way over time. And as a child, it's very frustrating. But as you get older, you realize what a tremendous masmid this really is. I remember from those years in yeshiva as well that my father often would be called out to a meeting or to something, and it could last an hour or two or sometimes an entire afternoon. Sometimes he would be busy one afternoon and come back 2 or 3 afternoons later, and he would literally pick up right in the middle of where we left off. And he was surprised why I wasn't holding there.
Speaking about your father as a public figure and someone who had to deal with, still does deal extensively with Sarkha Tibor, did it ever frustrate you or bother you to see your father's name in the newspaper or hear him spoken about, you know, specifically in the world at large? You know, there are lots of different kinds of people, and not everyone has the same reverence for great Talmidei Chachamim, and sometimes things get very political. I'm sure things weren't always favorable. How does the child react to something like that?
It's a great question. For us as children, it was always very painful. And we learned a number of great lessons. The first and probably most important lesson that we learned from our father being spoken about on the blogs or in the newspapers or wherever it may have been, or people speaking behind his back or in front of his face in disrespectful ways, probably the most important lesson that we learned is that the story is almost never the way it's being reported. You know, we lived the stories and we saw actually what was going on. And then we also used to watch how it was reported and we were shocked. How could it be that there's such a distortion? How could it be that people are willing to be so dishonest? And my father also always told us as children, he said that whenever I'm attacked in the newspaper, and he said it happens every so often, he told us, my revenge is that I'm not going to read it. And my father always says, I'm going to show them. They want me to read it. They want me to get upset. I'm just not going to read it. And I can tell you that my father literally never read them. I also remember very vividly that even when all this was going on in the background and so many people were talking about my father, and I remember at times there were lawyers who would call me that they wanted to speak to me about a statement. What can Rav Schechter say? How can he respond? And with all that pressure going on in the background, my father was literally just sitting and learning as if nothing happened. And I do know that there are many who are not so respectful to my father as they should be. And, you know, I remember just recently that my father was asked to call a certain gavir on behalf of a certain yeshiva. And my father, being the tremendous Baal Midos and Baal Chesed that he is, said absolutely he'd be happy to call, but he told me that he thinks it would be a better sell if he went to visit the yeshiva, because this way he can tell the gvir on the phone something about the yeshiva, and he can tell them personally that he went to see it and that he saw beautiful things there. So my father called and asked that he wanted to arrange a meeting in that yeshiva, And I remember that they responded to him that, you know, Rav Shechter is not our hashkafa. We don't really want him coming, and it's not really the kind of person that we want our talmidim meeting. And I was so hurt. I was so upset by that. I couldn't believe it. And my father's response was, okay, so I'll call the gvir without visiting the yeshiva. Like, what? Why should they lose out just because they don't agree with me? Just because they might not respect what I stand for? Like, they're still yeshiva. They're Marbitei Torah, they're Chashuvei Talmidei Chachamim, and they deserve to be supported. And that, to me, was a tremendous lesson. You know, just because people out there might not agree with you, people out there might not respect you, my father always taught us that we have to look beyond that, and we have to be able to look at the bigger picture, at the overall perspective.
It reminds me of when your father told us about how Rav Soloveitchik used to write checks to all different kinds of yeshivas, and one of the collectors for was in Turikarta or a Satmi yeshiva or something, would go around showing the check that he got from Rav Soloveitchik. So I guess that was a lesson that he learned from his Rebbe to be giving to everybody.
Yep.
Now, you chose to go into the family business. Some of your siblings did, some of your siblings didn't, but being, like, I can imagine, like, being a doctor when your father is a world-renowned surgeon or something like that, it might have its pluses and its minuses. Are there anything that you found that being a Rav, a Marbitz Torah, in your own right, that were particularly helpful because of your upbringing, or particularly hurtful because of your upbringing? I'm not talking about, like, the general sense, which I don't think you were the beneficiary of, that you have in a lot of places where it's just like a Yerusha, where the Rabbanus goes to Yerusha, because I don't think that's happened with you. But just from your experiences, has it been helpful or hurtful? Do people have different expectations of you because of that?
Very interesting question. You know, my parents, when we grew up, my parents never, ever allowed us to use our last name for anything. And I remember very vividly that at some point in my years in Beis Medrash, I wanted to switch from one yeshiva to another, and it was in the middle of the year, and they wouldn't even give me an opportunity to come for an interview for a faher. And then I found out later on that my father was actually the Rebbe of the Rosh Yeshiva of that yeshiva. So I said, Daddy, you know, maybe you can call on my behalf and let him know that it's your son. And my father got very upset, and he said, why would I do that? If you belong in that yeshiva and you deserve to get in, then you'll get in on your own. And if not, then you shouldn't be there. Why would I call them just because you're my son? And at times that really frustrated us as children, that my father would never ever use his name or his connections for us in any area at all of life. And as we get older, at least I appreciated very much that my father pushed us to make lives of our own, and my father really wanted us to be successful on our own. I do remember as a child that my father quoted us the Gemara Maseches Sanhedrin, where the Gemara tells us about a melech, that one of the jobs of a melech is that he has to write a Sefer Torah, and v'kara bal kol yemei chayav, he has to read from the Sefer Torah and seek counsel and guidance from the Sefer Torah all the days of his life, all the time. And my father mentioned to us that the Gemara says there, afal pi shekos sheinichalo of the Sefer Torah, even if one's father was the melech and left him a Sefer Torah, still the Gemara says, mitzvah sheyichtav mishalo, he has an obligation to commission a Sefer Torah to be written on his own when he takes upon the leadership role in the community. And my father told us that this is an important lesson for every member of Klal Yisrael, but it was so relevant to my father's own children, and that is, even if you had a great father and he leaves you over a Sefer Torah, which our father does give us a tremendous Sefer Torah, my father encouraged us that mitzvah sheyichtav mishalo, we all have an obligation in life to really carve out our own relationship with our HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to figure out what it is that we are going to do, how we're going to be successful, how we try to spend our time. And my father never, ever pushed us that we should go into the Rabbanus. He never was advocating for one thing or the other. He says all the time that he's proud of his children who have figured out, you know, whatever professions they're in on their own. And I have sisters who have PhDs, and I have a brother who's in business and another brother who's in chinuch. And my father is so equally proud of all of them because he used to stress this very often, mitzvah sheyichtov mishalo, that we should all really try to write our own Sefer Torah and try to figure out how to develop our own meaning and relationship in life itself. And, you know, you say about how it could be helpful that I have a father like this. Well, first of all, probably one of the most important things in any position of Rabbanus anywhere in the world is that you need Shimush Tamid HaChachamim. You need to be able to experience what it means to live a life as a Rav and to experience the challenges and experience the kinds of responses and the attitudes that we need to have when dealing with Tzarchei Tzibur. And that's something that obviously being the child of such parents is something that we all saw as children from a very young age and we're privileged to be a major part of. It obviously helps us deal with the things that come up in our lives and in our shuls and in our communities. Obviously today, when I get complicated shilas, which, you know, in every community there are always going to be complicated shilas, and almost always these kinds of questions are way beyond my expertise, which is limited, and way beyond my understanding. And it's a tremendous bracha to have my father and other great gedolim around who are able to address these questions and who have an understanding into the workings of our communities and an understanding in how to deal with the challenges that we all face. And I'm often reminded of the Gemara Masechet Shabbos, where we're told, Tamas Chusavas. The Gemara there says that we no longer have Chusavas, and Tosfos asks the Kasha, how could it be? Don't we know that every day in Shemona Esrei we talk about Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, so how can you say that Chusavas has run out? So Tosfos gives an answer, but I remember that there's a vart from the Rishoner where he says, Tamas Chusavas doesn't mean that it ran out, but rather that we are matmiya, we are so overwhelmed, we are so amazed by the chusavos that we have. When we think about the stories of our ancestors, of our fathers, and we consider how incredible their lives are and how much they've accomplished, that is a davar tamua, that is something that is absolutely amazing. And that's what I think about often when I take a step back and consider how blessed and lucky our family, our children are to be the children of such a great person, that, you know, we are matmiya, we are amazed that this person who is so shakua in Tzarchei Tzibur, but so shakua in Talmud Torah, but at the same time so dedicated to other people and so dedicated to Klal Yisrael and does so many things l'shem shamayim, it's an amazing schusavos to be privileged to have.
You've spoken a lot about the positives, and I'm sure there are very many, but you must notice that there are other rabbis' children who seem to be more rebellious and seem to not want to stay on the path of their fathers or do anything but what their father does. Do you think that's real, first of all? Do you think that's true? And if so, like, what sorts of feelings would a child have that would lead him to those kinds of...
I definitely struggled with it for many years, you know, trying to figure out how to create my own identity and how to be my own person. It's definitely not easy, and, you know, for many years you try to run away from it. I think that's natural for a child to try to run away from it and create themselves. I remember I went with a group of friends to Australia for a summer. We were on a seed program. And on the way down, we stopped in Hong Kong for Shabbos because we couldn't take a direct flight from Eretz Yisrael. So we went to Hong Kong for Shabbos, and I said to myself as we were there, I'm like, I'm in the farthest place in the world that I can possibly be from my parents, and it made me so excited. I was 19 years old, and I was just thrilled to be really far away and in a place where nobody would know me. So Friday night we go to shul, and the Rav in Hong Kong is giving some kind of shiur, and he's looking around, and he's trying to be interactive, and he says, okay, who knows the answer to this question? He asked some kind of complicated question, and he's, you know, nobody raised their hand. We were all shy. And he says, okay, Schechter in the back, what do you say? And I was shocked. I said, what does that mean? And he says, I'm about to quote something from one of your father's svarim. How do you not know the answer? And I remember vividly that there was an article that came out years ago from Rabbi Yoel Schoenfeld. He's a Rav in Queens, and he's also the son of a very prominent Rav, Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. And they once interviewed Rabbi Yoel Schoenfeld, and they asked him, you know, what is it like to always be living in your father's shadow? And Rabbi Yoel Schoenfeld responded, and he said, my perspective is not that I'm living in my father's shadow, but rather that I am forever basking in my father's light. You know, once you are able to shift that perspective, it makes things very different. I remember when I was learning in Eretz Yisrael, my father once came to give some shiurim, and he told me to meet him in Beit Vegan. That's where he was staying. So I got on a bus, and I had a little Gemara Pesachim with me. That's what we were learning at the time. And I sit down on the bus, I open the Gemara to the Perek Arvei Pesachim, and somebody next to me with a big white straw hat and a long beard with khaki pants sits down next to me, and 5 minutes in he says, "Nu, bachur ma telomed?" And I'm rolling my eyes like, what does this guy want from me? Why is he bothering me? Just leave me alone. And he starts engaging in conversation. I said, "I'm learning Masechet Pesachim." So he says, "What daf?" And we get in a whole discussion. And he says, "Me'efota?" I said, "New York." He said, "Where?" I said to myself, he's not going to know Washington Heights. I said, "Manhattan." So he says, "Where in Manhattan?" I said, "Washington Heights." He said, "Washington Heights? Yeshiva University?" I said, "Yes." So he says, "What's your name?" I told him, "Shai Schechter." He says, "Ata ben shel Rav Schechter?" I said, "Yes, I am the son of Rav Schechter." He says, "Shalom aleichem, ani al ben shel Rav Shach. I'm the son of the Rosh Hashiva Rav Shach." And I thought the guy was making fun of me. I thought he was kidding. So then he got all offended, and he took out his two dat zehut to show me that his name is really Shach. And this is the famous son of Rav Shach, who there are many stories told about him. But it was very interesting to sit with him and to have this discussion. Actually, one of the things we spoke about was, what was it like being the son of Rav Shach? And how did you deal with creating your own identity?
In this entire conversation, I haven't asked about your mother's role in all of this. I imagine that the fact that you are who you are and that your siblings are who they are is not only because your father knew how to handle his own public persona and balance that with regular family life, but probably is more attributable to your mother, I would imagine. Is that fair to say? Am I treading in an area that I shouldn't talk about over here, or is that any thoughts about that?
My mother is definitely a personality in her own right. What comes to mind when you talk about my mother is somebody once came over to my mother and asked her, "What is it like to be married to a Gadol B'Yisrael?" And my mother said, "I don't know. You better ask my husband." So, you know, she is definitely a personality, and she kept things very lively in our home and continues to do so. But, you know, part of being the kind of public figure that my father is also invites a certain type of people to frequent the house. So, obviously, you're privileged to meet tremendous Talmidei Chachamim and great Rashi Yeshiva, and sometimes you meet very famous politicians and very famous personalities. But outside of that, you also encounter many, many, I don't know how to say it respectfully, many people who are in tremendous need and sometimes who have tremendous difficulty and major problems, and who might not be, you know, the best people that you want your children spending time with in your house. You know, my father always told us the story about how Rav Soloveitchik said when he went to Rav Chaim's house when he was a young child, he was scared to go in because there were so many Mishagoyim who were roaming around the house that Rav Soloveitchik felt like almost scared to go into Rav Chaim's house. And Rav Chaim was a legend for his chesed.
They say about Rav Chaim that he had they asked him, "Why do you have a front door if anyone can come in anyway?" He said, "To be Yaitse Shita Sarambam in Mezuzah, that you need a door in order to be Chayiv in Mezuzah with Daraisa."
So, you know, that's legendary about Rav Chaim's kindness. But the truth is, for a family, it's very, very taxing and it's very difficult. And you need somebody to make sure that there's a balance there. On the one hand, you know, you might have people coming in and they do have needs, but at the same time, you need to sometimes know how to close the door, and you need to know how to sometimes make sure that people do not enter the house. I recently told my father that I saw a drasha of the Sri De'esh in his Sefer Lefrakim, where Rav Weinberg in the Sri De'esh writes that this is what it means when Rashi says on Chumash that Sarah Imenu was responsible for the Anan that was on top of the oil of Avraham Avinu. So he says, we always understand that to mean that there was such ruchnius from Sarah Imenu that there was like a holy cloud that was on top of the tent. But the Sri De'esh suggests that maybe part of the job of a prominent Jewish wife is that she serve as the Anan. Although Avraham Avinu's tent was open and he allowed everybody in, But she had to be the barrier, and she had to sometimes say, you know, we're going to put a cloud over the tent, and we're going to monitor what comes in and what goes out. You know, people like Manhige Yisrael have somebody there who can always be the balance and who can always make sure that certain influences come in the house and certain influences, you know, stay away from the home.
You spoke a lot about the dealing with being in the public eye, but you must have had some very unusual experiences for a child to have. You must have seen, like you mentioned before, great people, great Talmidei Chachamim. Are there any interesting stories of your father's interactions with other Gedolei Torah or prominent personalities that you think would be interesting for the audience to hear or instructive in some way?
My father, as I said, is such a humble person. So often when he's in the presence of another Gadol B'Yisrael, he's very quiet and he really doesn't want to show what he's all about, and he really carefully measures his words when he's in their presence. My mother told me that after my father knew Rav Soloveitchik for probably 25 or 30 years already, and he was in the shir, and he was a Talmud, and he spoke to him, my mother said she remembers that they had an opportunity to be together in the car. I think she said they were going to a wedding together or something, and Rav Soloveitchik was sitting in the front seat, and somebody was driving, and my parents were in the back. And my mother said she remembers that my father was sitting there literally shaking in the back seat with his hands between his knees, that he couldn't open his mouth. He couldn't bring himself to have a conversation, a casual conversation with Rav Soloveitchik. Even though he knew him for so many years and he was known to be a very close Talmud of his, my father's tremendous respect that he has for other Talmidei Chachamim is something that is always incredibly inspiring. I remember somebody was writing a biography about the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and they called our house one evening because they wanted to include a chapter about the relationship between the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Rav Soloveitchik. They knew each other from Berlin, and then I think they continued on the relationship in some way. So they wanted to know, you know, what Rav Soloveitchik felt about his special relationship with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So they called my parents' home one night, and they asked my father when they'd be able to interview him, when they'd be able to come over and speak with him about it. And my father asked them, did you speak to this Talmud? Did you speak to that one? And they said, yes. So my father said, why are you calling me? Why do you think that I would have more to share than they did? And they responded, what do you mean? Like, you were a Talmud of his for so long. You must have had conversations with him along the way about this. And my father, I remember vividly, my father answered, I don't remember having a casual conversation with Rav Soloveitchik. He said, like, I lived in awe of him, and he was my Rebbe, and I understood what he represented and all that he was about, and I don't remember having casual conversations with him. And that was so telling to me, that you can have such a long-standing relationship with someone, and yet your humility doesn't allow you to ever cross the boundary of the kavod and the dignity that this Talmud Chacham deserves, and your own personal growing into become a personality on your own. That is something that's amazing. But maybe one final story that I'll share with you was, I remember when I was in Rav Asher Arieli Shir in the Mir Yeshiva, so my father was coming to Eretz Yisrael for something, and I thought it would be the right thing that my father should meet Rav Asher Arieli and thank him for, you know, for his Harbatzos Torah, and, you know, just out of Hakar Satov, I thought it was the right thing. So I went to Rav Asher Arieli and I said, you know, I'd like to bring my father over on Shabbos. Is that okay? So he said, oh, you know, I would be very uncomfortable if Rav Schechter went out of his way to come to me. How about tell me where you're going to be and I'll come visit him. So Rav Asher Arieli is also legendary for his humility. And I remember that I told him, you know, my father's giving a shiur here, he's giving a shiur there, he's going to be running around. How about, you know, we'll just come to your house? So he reluctantly agreed, and I hope to never forget what happened when we actually came to Rav Asher Arieli's house. So we got there, and there was a very small conversation between Rav Asher Arieli and my brother-in-law, who was also in the shiur and a very close Talmud of his. So they got in a small conversation, and then that finished up. Then I felt so awkward that it was just silence in the room. So I started to ask Rav Asher Arieli something about the shiur from the week before. It was about Rav and Chazaka. We were learning Baba Basra. So I thought it's a major inyan, it's a major sugya, so my father will have something to say, he'll contribute to the conversation. And Rav Asher Ely gave some clarification to whatever it was that he said in the shir. And then, you know, that was it. My father didn't say anything. And my father stood up, and he thanked Rav Asher Ely very much for his hashpa and for all of his Arbatzis Torah. And then we left. You know, he wished him a good Shabbos, and we left. Now, remember when we walked into the hallway, my father started to cry. And he said, you don't understand the schus of how lucky you are to learn by such a tremendous anav. And, you know, I obviously didn't fully appreciate what it meant, and I still don't fully appreciate the tremendous chus, but that was my father's perspective. Sunday morning, Rav Asher Ely came over to me in yeshiva, and he says, you know, thank you so much for bringing your father over, but he said, I wasn't aware that there were still such balei midos who existed in the world today. And Rav Asher said, I just want to thank you for bringing your father to meet me. It was the first time that we met each other. And he said, the midos are so obvious that I was just overwhelmed that we were able to sit together. Now, this experience for me was amazing because I said to myself, I was sitting there and there was no, basically, no exchange of words and learning. But there was a conversation that they had in their own minds, and it was an amazing exchange just in silence of sitting in each other's presence. Neither one of them wanting to assert themselves, neither one of them wanting to show what great Talmidei Chacham they were, and both just sitting with tremendous humility and appreciating each other's company. And to me, it was such a powerful lesson that I firmly believe I was the only uncomfortable person in the room. I was the only one who was feeling awkward about the fact that there was nothing being spoken about. And the two of them were extremely comfortable in each other's presence, even though there was a very, very minimal exchange of words between these great personalities.
Wow, that's a beautiful story. That's a great way to conclude. And I just want to thank you again very much. I think this was fascinating and very, very interesting for me to hear, and I'm sure for many others. So thank you again for your time and for being so giving of your experiences with us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, a pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay.
When we were thinking about who we should interview about the topic of rabbis' kids and the risk factors and their emotional development and the emotional development of children, of public figures, the very first person that came to mind was obviously Dr. Pelkovic. He's both a psychologist to the entire Frum community on all ends of the spectrum, revere and Pelkovic, as well as the son of a great rabbi, Ralph Pelkovic, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. And additionally, this isn't only about the children of rabbis, but about the children of very busy public personalities. And Dr. Pelkovic himself is one of the busiest and most well-known people in the Orthodox community. So he's really coming at this from three different angles. And knowing his children and what an outstanding job he did raising them, it's particularly meaningful to have the opportunity to talk to him. So welcome, Dr. Pelkovic, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay, so let's get right into it. You know, there's a lot of discussion. I remember as a growing up, I had three boys in my class whose fathers were rabbis. And even as kids, we used to always talk about rabbi son syndrome. And I didn't know exactly what it meant, but the sense that I got was that there was a perception, at least, that rabbi's kids can sometimes be more rebellious than other children. So I just want to know, first of all, is that true? Are there, even among other religions, that children of clergy members or very public people or very busy people tend to be more rebellious or more problematic at certain stages?
Yeah, I think that like everything else in psychology, I think that's an invidium also, is the answer is it depends. It very much depends. I mean, there's kind of a tarta de sastra, like a very interesting duality and a little empirical research done on this. On the one hand, we all know, we've seen it with our own eyes, that there's a certain tendency on the part of boys in particular to rebel, and it's certainly more salient because everybody will say, "Oh, it's the rabbi's kid. We expect more of you." So we've seen it, and I think that perception is true in certain cases. But there are also many, many kids who really do fine with it. You know, maybe we'll talk a little bit about what some of the research has shown is associated with resilience in these kids and what's associated with risk. But certainly by no means does being a rabbi's son or daughter guarantee that there are going to be problems. My favorite quotation from Dr. Saul Levitz's study on this, who's a psychologist who was a rabbi and has been living in Israel for the last number of years and has done the only real empirical research on this that I'm familiar with, is that it's true that almost every rabbi's son and daughter complained about being in that position and unfair expectations, but it's also true, he said, that virtually everybody he studied, and he studied 40 adult children and rabbis, everybody he interviewed was upset when their fathers retired.
Wow, that's so interesting. I see with my own children. I'm rabbi of a smaller community, but my sons, each react differently to it, and each handle it differently. But at least one of them were embarrassed if their friends knew that their father was a rabbi. In camp, in the summer, one of my sons, when he was younger, pretended I was his uncle, actually. And my daughter is like so proud. All she wants to do is shout from the rooftops that my father's the rabbi, and she's, tell everybody who will listen. And I wonder if that's typical. Do sons and daughters react differently? You know, growing up, we always heard rabbi-son syndrome. Are there differences between the way boys and girls handle this?
Yeah, I think so. Again, I'm not aware that there's been research on enough numbers to really answer it. I think that in some ways it could be particularly stressful on rabbi-sons. You know, boys may be somewhat more likely to be challenging or to act out, but also, you know, the rabbi's sons are exposed so much more. They're in shul every day, sometimes, you know, often twice a day. They're also, there seems to be, somehow people feel very comfortable. Men feel maybe more comfortable than women going to rabbi's sons before their father gives the drasha, to say, hey, make sure your father doesn't speak too long today, or complaining about...
I've had that a few times.
Yeah, right. And so I think that it's just like a dose-response relationship. They're exposed a lot more, and I think that, at least from what I could see, I'm not minimizing, because on daughters there's equal kinds of pressures, but not quite that constant drip of daily exposure.
Now, would it depend on what kind of, I imagine it would, and what kind of rabbi we're talking about? There's got to be a difference between a Hasidish Rebbe, where it's understood that his son is supposed to be his Nemali Makom, versus a rabbi of a modern Orthodox shul, or a Litvish Rosh Yeshiva. I guess, like you said, there's no research on it, but what have your experiences told you about those different segments of the community?
Yeah, so I've seen it in very many different iterations, where, for example, I've worked with some families with a Hasidic Rebbein. And if the person who's ultimately destined to take over, if it fits his temperament and it's something that he wants and he has a good close relationship with his father, then you just see a really beautiful kind of connection and teamwork between them, especially if the father is able to patiently groom his son and model for him and allow him to find his own voice. When, though, there's a process that goes on where there's a lack of balance, let's say, where where, and it doesn't matter if it's the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva or the Rav of a modern Orthodox shul, when they allow the job to totally take over their life and they don't clear that time for their children and they don't figure out a way to make time to carve out kind of shul-free zone in their family life, that's what I think there's a problem. But it's always an interaction of temperament and match and balance.
I always thought that the story with Yaakov and Esav, that the the way the Chumash tells us how Yitzchak got better with Esav and Rivka with Yaakov, was that at least part of it is that sometimes a parent connects better, or places less pressure on the child that's not like them, the child that's more like the spouse than like them. I'd be totally off base over here, but I sometimes see in families that, and I'm sure you'll tell me if I'm off base, but I sometimes see in families that the child who's just like the parent has such a hard time with that child. Like he sees either all of his own failings, or he sees, or he just wants the kid to be more. I don't know what's behind that. Whereas if a person is in love with his spouse and there's a kid that's just like his spouse, it seems to work a lot better. First of all, is that fair to say? Is that accurate? Is that totally off base?
You mean that it's a matter of that the difficulties with the kid who is marching to the beat of a different drum that feels alien to the father? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, I was actually suggesting
The opposite. You're suggesting the opposite. I hear that you're suggesting there's the greater the similarity, the greater the closeness, and the greater the emotional reactivity, because it's hard to take a step back and to have that dispassionate point of view. I've definitely seen that. That there's like anything else in life, we have to find that middle path, and when there's an intense closeness, maybe because of how much is invested in the designated heir or whatever. In general, any time I think that in a parent-child relationship we get invested in wanting our child to turn out a certain way, or wanting to save our children from making mistakes we made, we're just getting invested in there being a specific path for a kid rather than following the unique the nigun yuchad, the unique melody of that child. It's a setup for problems. So yeah, I would very much agree with that as making a lot of sense. Yeah.
Interesting. You mentioned carving out time for every child. I remember years ago, I think 20 years ago, I attended a seminar given by Rabbi J.J. Schachter in Boston, when he was living in Boston, for young rabbanim. At the time, I was young, so I qualified. It was, a little less than 20 years ago. And he spoke about the importance of spending time with your children. And he quoted a Rambam about Avraham Avinu went around from town to town getting people to believe in the one and only Ribono Shel Olam. And he made tens of thousands of converts. He had tens of thousands of followers. But what happened to all those tens of thousands of followers? At the end of the day, ki bi Yitzchak yikari l'chazera, that everything came through Yitzchak. He came through his own children, and that the one area that you know that you're supposed to be doing as a rabbi, the one set of people that you know the Ribono Shel Olam definitely wants you to be mashpia on, are your own children. Everybody else, maybe yes, maybe no, but your own children. For sure. So given that and the point you made about carving out time for your own children, this is not only for Rabbanim, Hatzalah members who are running out at all hours of the night, people with busy jobs in general, where work time encroaches on home time, what are some tips that you might give to make sure that you don't sort of fall into that trap and to make sure that you are spending the right amount of time with your children.
Yes, I mean, I think that that it's largely, number one, about clarity. Putting that front and center. But I think the most effective Rav, or the most effective leader, or the most effective person who's Osek Tzarfei Tzibur, they're gonna be much more effective if they model for others. And they have really front and center in their mind the fact that they ultimately their wives and children have to come first. And I think paradoxically that makes them into good role models, and I think it makes them into better leaders. There's all kinds of interesting research on rebbetzins, on rabbis' wives, showing that they in fact their number one complaint is often about how sometimes the demands of the rabbanus totally engulfs their lives and leads to stress. And to the extent that Rav and the rabbinic family is able to create a shul-free sphere in their home, I think it can make an enormous difference. And have them view it as sort of like, okay, this is like a community kind of thing. I see sometimes in the Lubavitch community where it's viewed as a family business, and where
everyone's involved.
And I think that not that there aren't problems there also, but I often see this amazing kind of upbringing for those kids because they literally. Many of them view it as a partnership and as a team. I have this memory of growing up in the White Shul of us helping out, and in a way that was fun. So we would help back in the pre-email era, where we would help stuff envelopes, or we would help with mass mailings, or we'd help set up the shul for or set up for a shiur. I mean, I remember my father would always, have a list of sparring for me to get, and I would sit near him sometimes during a shiur and put, I was asked to get to. He made sure to, in some ways, actively involve all of us, as did my mother, Allah Shalom, and it made it. I certainly had, much lower level of resentment than I would have otherwise because of that.
Wow, what would be some of the warnings that a child maybe needs more attention? I find sometimes when, I'm sure you find this a lot, that when someone needs help, by the time they look for help and they look, they're so far down the road. Like I find this with marriages a lot of times, that a couple will come to me and ask for a recommendation for a therapist, and very often. By the time they do that, the marriage is pretty much over. So it would be unfortunate if a parent waited to see that his child was completely rebelling before reacting to it. What would be some of the early warning signs? Like, how would you differentiate between kids seeing something that's maybe a troubling sign of where a child is headed?
Yeah, so I mean, the number one thing I think you look for is any change in behavior. If you have a kid who seems to have been doing well and now there's a shift, and that could happen. It could be that a kid is really well adjusted, but then when he or she hits adolescence and they're more self-aware or maybe more sensitive, I know that I remember that when I was either in camp or in school, that if a bunch of my friends were gathered around, maybe sharing, telling inappropriate jokes, let's say, or sharing inappropriate material, which happened even back then in the 50s, when I would come nearby, there'd immediately be a silence. They say that, like, they changed the subject. And I remember that at a certain point when I was in adolescence, where the number one need of every teenager is to fit in, it became more of a challenge back then. you know, because you want to be like everybody else. So the way that might show itself, if it's surprised. Now, by the way, it wasn't the end of the world. It was a minor thing. To me, it becomes something that needs attention. If either it leads to a change, you know, that might show increased irritability, it might show some signs of sadness, some signs maybe of more acting out behavior that wasn't around there before, some more rebelliousness, and it may start relatively low level. You know, there's the story, I forget who I heard it from, but I think it's an often repeated story about the rabbi's son who started to become very rebellious. And when he was sent to a psychologist to talk about it, he said, "I was hoping that just like my father sits down with all the troubled kids in the shul, I was hoping that maybe I could get an appointment with him also." You know, so it's the key is to be on the lookout. Usually it's a change in behavior, or even if it's pre-existing behavior, the point that it becomes persistent, pervasive, or in any way interferes with day-to-day functioning, that's when you have a dark red flag that really needs to be dealt with sooner rather than later.
You mentioned something there that I find very, very interesting, and that is that experience you had feeling left out, feeling different from everybody else. On a certain level, that's going to happen with rabbis. Meaning, how many rabbis do I know that their kid is the only kid in the community or in his school without a TV in his house? You know, the internet's somewhat of an equalizer, maybe without a smartphone or without some. So there are certain things that he's just going to be different. How should a parent try to make sure that he doesn't feel left out, that he doesn't feel different from everybody else? There's some way to manage that. I assume you shouldn't just tell him to, like, you know, just be like everybody else. He does hold a certain standard in his life.
Yeah, and that's a really common question. You know where I really get that? I get that most from children of, like, principals. You know, children of Jewish educators who are administrators, you know, who are often living in different parts of the country where they're held to a much tougher standard than all their friends are. And it really is hard. And you have to have seichel in knowing when to be flexible and when not to be flexible. I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that it has to be done in a way that you empathize with the kid, you allow them to be upset, you figure out there might be a time, for example, I can think of a situation where when kids are only getting together through texting, and you know, maybe a time to have a kosher phone that at least allows texting, you know, and I find that when parents have are firm and understanding in terms of having their eye on the ball, in terms of what their goal is, and at the same time know when to be flexible. It's like, you know, everything else, finding the balance between love and limits with this.
Right.
But the most important thing, I think, is you validate. You allow them to be upset. You allow them to be angry. And don't feel that just because you're empathizing with their being upset, that validation isn't the same as agreeing with giving in on it. And it's an art, and it's going to be very different for each of the kids. What is it the Kutzler said? There's nothing as unequal as the equal treatment of children. So it'll depend on the kid. It'll depend on their temperament.
Right. Well, it's, someone once told me that he feels that parents make their mistakes on their oldest children, and then they sort of figure it out with the younger children. I really don't find that to be the case at all.
Yeah.
Each child is so different, and you just have more pressures in life by the time the younger children are there.
And I often see along those lines that it's often the youngest child who's the greatest risk for serious behavioral problems. At least, and there is some research on that, just in general.
Why is that?
Well, I think because to a certain extent, by the time you get down to your youngest, parents might be much more relaxed, much more flexible, and they may find a hard time finding that balance. So they might be coasting, and they might be there might be less supervision than you know. Again, what works best is the middle ground. So any extreme on either end. You know, with older kids, the tendency is to be maybe a little bit too rigid. With younger kids, a little bit too lax. And in either case, unless you find that middle path, it's not going to work.
Right. Now, if I can get personal to your circumstance and your amazing father, did your father ever, you know, your grandfather was a Rav also. My father-in-law actually just showed me the Sefer written by Rav Shimon Shkop that your grandfather gave to my father-in-law at his dharma, and he told him in Bridgeport, Connecticut, I think it was, right?
Yes.
So he told my father-in-law that I never thought I'd be able to give a bar mitzvah boy a sefer chidush of Rav Shimon, who's actually going to be able to understand it. So considering that it was generations in your family, did you ever feel pressure? Did your father ever apply any pressure to go to
and it goes even past. I think my great grandfather also was Slabodka, like real Litvish long line of Rabbanim. Interestingly, my father never had the least bit of pressure, I think, on any of us to do anything other than find our way and find our path. As a matter of fact, in a way, when I was I was in Torah V'das, and went through Chulin and Yerideya there, you know, with the expectation that I'd get smicha. He said, look, great, you could get smicha if you want to be a shul rav, but he says otherwise, you know, it's just you know, he actually didn't feel that it made sense to have smicha if I wasn't going to be using it for using it professionally. He was very good about letting, I think, each of us, me and my siblings, kind of find whichever way our heart drew us, and it worked. I mean, it worked in the sense that I think we each found what worked for us, and he believed in us. He had trust in us. So after having learned the Torah V'das for a number of years, when I decided that I wanted to go get my doctorate in Philadelphia, which very few of my friends would have been allowed to do that, to just pick up and leave New York and go off to the University of Pennsylvania, which was a hotbed of all kinds of not such great stuff going on back there then, in the height of the Vietnam War protests and everything like that. So I remember both my parents totally, totally supported the idea of us going, you know, with the idea that if we didn't do our job by now, then forget it. And the fact that he believed in us and helped us find our way, helped us find our own inner, you know, sort of, you know, what our signature strengths were, was something that the older I get, the more I appreciate it, you know, because that was his philosophy of life, and as well as my mother, Allah Shalom. You know, so I think that, later on, that's when we started. I think because he preserved that kind of relationship, that's when we started to actively collaborate and writing a couple of books together. And we were often joint scholars in residence in different parts of the world. And it was amazing. We became much closer, I think, than we would have been otherwise, because he preserved that level of independence.
It's so amazing that the irony of it is that you overlapped tremendously into what you do, serving Klal Yisrael, inspiring people, educating people, but because you did it in different ways, it made sense to bring you as joint scholars in residence. It made sense for you to collaborate on a book, whereas rabbis don't typically collaborate on a book. It doesn't really add much if they're coming with the same skill set. But yeah, that's so inspiring that specifically because he recognized your kochos,
right? And
you were able to complement each other.
At my bar mitzvah, I'll always remember the drasha he gave at my bar mitzvah, which happened to be the first bar mitzvah in the new Weitzel building back in 1964. And I remember standing up there, you know, that awkward moment when the Rav is giving the drasha to the bar mitzvah boy and, you know, the kid is looking at him. His message was that his dream was to give the world a good listener. He said, if I could give the world just one good listener, I'll be a very happy man. And I don't know how powerful a bar mitzvah speech could be, but somehow I imagine that he was picking up on, you know, on wanting to fan the flames of whatever quality he saw in me that was able, hopefully, to do that.
That's remarkable. But at the age of 13, he already saw that in you, because, I mean, that's what you do. That's really unbelievable. Yeah.
No, go ahead. I was just thinking that, you know, I was lucky. We're all very lucky to, you know, to have that.
So I think that's a great way to end, because I find that so inspiring. And I just want to thank you again for, I know how valuable your time is. I probably don't. I don't really understand fully just how busy you are. But I just want to thank you again for taking the time to speak with me this morning. I think people will gain a tremendous amount from this, both rabbis and non-rabbis. I think everyone will gain a tremendous amount from it. So I appreciate it so much.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It was like a good therapy session. You're a great therapist.
Okay, take care. Have a good day.
Okay, thanks. Okay, bye.
Let's go to the chosen winner of this week's riddle.
This weekly riddle, the problem of Derish El Amesim in Derish to the Mikdom is the Shulchan Aruch says you're not allowed to the Teretz Mima in the Sefer Tesefes Brocha says and differentiates between whether you're Derish and ask a Bakasha from the Mace or you ask the Mace to be Mavakish from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, like we say, Malachi Rachmi Meshose Elyon Chalun Opne Kale. So that's when we're asking the Malachim to plead to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's Beseder. So that's the solution to that problem. And as far as that, the only Moshe, the question on the Shach, so there's a few Terutzim. There's one Teretz that since Yehoshua was upset that Eldor Medad were declaring that Moshe was Mace and Yeshua Machnis and Oris, he wanted to declare that Moshe was the Adoin, and he said Adoini Moshe, to show not to disrespect Atul Peker, to show that he was the exclusive Adoin and nobody else was the monarch of Kol Yisrael. And we have a raya to this from Batsheva, who says Yechi Adoini Amelech David Loilom. Even though during the whole speech discussing with him, she calls him Adoni Amelech, but at the end, when he told her that Shlomo was going to be the king, so she declared by that saying, Yitchi Adoni Amelech Le'olam, that David is really the exclusive and all-time Melech Yisrael. Kol Tov, Zayin Gezeirah.